Welcome to America's Providential History Podcast, where we talk about the real story of America and explore the hand of God in our history. Now, here's your host, Stephen McDowell.
Hello, glad you're joining us for this edition of America's Providential History Podcast. Last week, we began to look at the faith of some of our presidents, beginning with George Washington. And I began to introduce you to the Christian character and Christian faith of this indispensable man, the father of our country, the man without which there would be no United States of America as we know it today. And in this podcast, I want to continue this story of Washington. So we looked last week of how Washington was a man prepared and used by God. He was an example of Christian character, and it was that Christian character that sustained him during the War for Independence, as it was throughout his whole life. And in particular, we looked at what they went through, he and his troops went through at the winter of Valley Forge. Now, today I want to explore more of his Christian character and the power of Christian character. You know, Washington was not very loud or talkative. He's not a great speaker, but he was very commanding in his words and presence. It's been said that the value and force of words depends upon who stands behind them, that is, upon the character of him who utters them. And so Washington, when he spoke, his words were powerful, and that's because of the character and the faith that were behind those words. Here's one incident that was recorded by a biographer, William Johnson. Reveals how this is true in the life of George Washington. Johnson writes, "So far back as 1756, we can find him, Washington, endeavoring to impress upon the soldiers under his command a profound reverence for the name and the majesty of God, and repeatedly in his public orders during the Revolution, the inexcusable offense of profaneness was rebuked. On a certain occasion, he had invited a number of officers to dine with him. While at table, one of them uttered an oath." Now, by the way, when Washington assumed command of the Continental Army in June of 1775, he issued orders to the troops. And in these very first orders, one of those orders was that he forbid his troops from using profanity, from swearing, which we would think, man, if we could keep them, just, you know, from doing all the other stuff they're doing, you know, compared to this. But Washington recognized the importance of controlling yourself, your tongue, being self-controlled. Because when people use profanity, it's an indication of what's in their heart. It's the deeper things that people appeal to, the words that come out of their mouth. And if Washington understood, as did early Americans, that if you can't govern your words and what you say, then it'll be difficult for you to govern how you live and how you act. And that's why forbidding the use of profanity was such an important thing to him. And so the troops knew this. His officers knew this. He knew this was one of the rules. And so that's why when these officers were dining with Washington during the war, when one of them uttered an oath, General Washington dropped his knife and fork in a moment. I'm back now quoting from William Johnson, historian William Johnson. Washington dropped his knife and fork in a moment, and in his deep undertone and characteristic dignity and deliberation said, "I thought that we all supposed ourselves gentlemen." He then resumed his knife and fork and went on as before. The remark struck like an electric shock, and, as was intended, did execution, as his observations in such cases were apt to do. No person swore at the table after that. When dinner was over, the officer referred to said to a companion that if the general had given him a blow over the head with his sword, he could have borne it, but that the home thrust which he received was too much. It was too much for a gentleman. See, the words of Washington had power, and that's because the character behind those words, this Christian character formed in him in his youth, in his home, and by the church, and by his own study and meditations, this is what made those words powerful. Well, as the Revolutionary War was coming to a close, a number of officers and soldiers began to grumble due to the many problems that existed in the new nation, including their lack of pay. So, you know, we had won the war, we were wrapping things up, getting ready to sign the peace treaty, which took almost 2 years from the last major battle of the war at Yorktown before that was signed. Washington still held the army together, even though fighting had, in essence, stopped in case it was needed. But during this time, a lot of the officers and soldiers began to grumble. That's because they were promised pay, they didn't receive pay, they endured great hardship, as we looked at last week, for example, at Valley Forge. And as a solution to the problems that Congress seemed unable to resolve, many officers wanted to set up a monarchy, making George Washington king. Well, Colonel Louis Nicola proposed the idea to Washington in a letter in the spring of 1782. And you might think, well, this is a strange proposal to make Washington king. We would never think of such a thing today. But then it was a very real possibility because the people loved him. The army loved him as well. And here was a group of officers who said, we're going to support you in this. And not only that, but they knew that Washington would not abuse any authority and power he had, that he would just use that position to help assure that our independence was sustained and that chaos didn't break out. And besides that, you know, throughout history, anytime a nation of people had a revolution, they would replace one king with another king. And so when they made this proposal, we might think it odd for such a proposal to be presented, but at the time, it really wasn't that odd at all and was a very real possibility. But Washington's response to this proposal of making him king reveals well the heart of this great man. And in a letter to Colonel Louis Nicola dated May 22, 1782, he wrote, and this is responding to the letter he'd received from him, hey, we've got problems and we think you becoming king can set everything aright. So Washington wrote, Sir, with a mixture of great surprise and astonishment, I've read with attention the sentiments you have submitted to my perusal. By the way, Washington was homeschooled. That's where he learned to communicate with such high literary literacy. And he goes on to say, Be assured, sir, no occurrence in the course of the war has given me more painful sensations than your information of there being such ideas existing in the army as you have expressed, and I must view with abhorrence and reprehend with severity. So he said, no occurrence in the course of the war has been more painful to him. And you remember last week we looked at the great misery and pain that took place at Valley Forge as he looked at his troops suffering and how much anguish that built in the heart of George Washington. But now he's saying, this is worse than that. This is worse than any of the hardships. No occurrence has given me more painful sensation than your information of being such ideas existing in the army of making me king. And then he said, I must view with abhorrence and reprehend with severity. So here it is, group of officers saying, we want to make you king. We'll support you. The people love you. We know you won't abuse your power and authority. You'll help set everything aright. And Washington's response, first thing he did is rebuke the guys. I must view with abhorrence and reprehend with severity. In essence, he's saying, look, what do you think we're fighting this war for? It's not to set up kings, it's to get rid of kings. And then he goes on and says, which reveals much about the heart of Washington, quote, I am much at a loss to conceive what part of my conduct could have given encouragement to an address which to me seems big with the greatest mischiefs that can befall my country. If I'm not deceived in the knowledge of myself, you could not have found a person to whom your schemes are more disagreeable. So the next thing he did, he looked at his own heart. In essence, he said, I hope there's nothing I said or done that would make you think I'd want to be king. As far as I know, I'm against the idea more than anyone. And he goes on to say, at the same time, in justice to my own feelings, I must add that no man possesses a more sincere wish to see ample justice done to the army than I do. And as far as my powers and influence in a constitutional way extend, they shall be employed to the utmost of my abilities to effect it, should there be any occasion. Let me conjure you, then, if you have any regard for your country, concern for yourself or posterity, or respect for me, to banish these thoughts from your mind and never communicate, as from yourself or anyone else, a sentiment of like nature. I am, sir, your most obedient servant. So Washington's response to the proposition of his being declared king was first to rebuke the officer who suggested the idea, and then to look within himself to see if his heart or actions were in any way in agreement with the idea, because he said, as far as he knew, he was against the idea more than anyone else. So what a great example of the Christian character of George Washington. And there's many others. In fact, you can read more in my book, Apostle of Liberty, The World-Changing Leadership of George Washington. Go to our website, providencefoundation.com, to order a copy. And you can also read in my book, In God We Trust Tour Guide, which gives a tour. It's a Christian history tour, Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, sites in Virginia. I have a chapter on Mount Vernon, Washington's home, and on his life, a summary of his life, and some of these stories and things I've been presenting here, you can find in that as well. But, you know, many people have declared that George Washington was the American Revolution, because without his leadership, we'd probably not have won our struggle for independence. He also thwarted an attempt to set up a monarchy, as we just looked at. But then shortly after the attempt to make him king, Washington was also instrumental in stopping a military coup. 10 months after Washington wrote to Nicola urging him to consider a constitutional means of resolving the problems facing them instead of making him king, a circular letter began appearing among the army calling for a military revolt. And to avert the national turmoil, Washington met with his officers on March 15, 1783, to hear their grievances and to help them in any way he could. So again, Washington didn't become king, but the situation in the country is still greatly challenged. And so the officers are saying something's got to be done. And again, that came up again, we're going to have a revolt and put the military in charge to set things right. So Washington said, okay, let's meet together and discuss what might be done. And so it was March 15, 1783. He met with them and let them know that he strongly opposed any civil discord. So after talking at length, the officers were still sullen and silent. His plea had failed to persuade them. Well, finally, he reached into his pocket and he pulled out a letter. And he said congressman anxious to help, and he wanted to read a letter describing what was being planned. So he held up the letter and tried to read it, and the writing was very small due to paper shortage. And a modern historian, Thomas Flexner, writes, "The officers stirred impatiently in their seats, and then suddenly every heart missed a beat. Something was the matter with His Excellency. He seemed unable to read the paper. He paused in bewilderment. He fumbled in his waistcoat pocket, and then he pulled out something that only his intimates had seen him wear, a pair of glasses. He explained, 'Gentlemen, you will permit me to put on my spectacles, for I have not only grown gray, but almost blind in the service of my country.' This simple statement achieved what all Washington's rhetoric and all his arguments had been unable to achieve. The officers were instantly in tears, and from behind the shining drops their eyes looked with love at the commander who had led them all so far and long. Washington quietly finished reading the congressman's letter, walked out of the hall, mounted his horse, and disappeared from the view of those who were staring from the window. All voted to support Washington for a peaceful, constructive approach to solve the problems, with one gentleman abstaining. And historians point to this speech as pivotal. Now, the reason it helped change the hearts of so many, because these men, these officers, had been with Washington, fought with Washington, saw how he acted, saw his sacrifice, knew he received no pay, and he slept out on the ground with his troops until during winter quarters before their huts were built. So before he moved into a home, they'd seen all the sacrifice that he had gone through and thought, not only that, but he's almost grown blind in service to his country, which helped turn their hearts and put aside this military coup. Thomas Jefferson wrote of Washington a year later after this, "The moderation and virtue of a single character have probably prevented this revolution from being closed, as most others have been, by a subversion of that liberty it was intended to establish." So this is why Washington has been called the indispensable man, and recognized by people at that time, like Thomas Jefferson, and so many Americans since that time, except, sadly enough, we don't teach these things in our government schools today. We don't teach about the father of our country, George Washington, and hold him up as an example to emulate for our young people. Well, in addition to his influence mentioned above in the birth of the United States of America, Washington was also instrumental in the establishment of our new republic under the Constitution. His role as president of the Constitutional Convention provided the stability necessary for the delegates to agree on a new constitution. After he was elected president of the convention, he stated, "Let us raise a standard to which the wise and honest can repair. The event is in the hand of God." Commenting on Washington's immense influence in the convention, James Monroe wrote to Jefferson on July 12, 1788, "Be assured, General, Washington's influence carried this government." And he also assured, Washington also assured its initial success by serving as the first president of the United States under the U.S. Constitution. So Washington was instrumental in us winning our independence and winning our struggle with Great Britain. He was instrumental in having a successful constitutional convention where the delegates came up with a marvelous form of government. It was sent to the states for approval, and after he was unanimously elected as the first president, two terms, only unanimously elected president we've had, and he set the example of how a chief executive ought to work. So without Washington, we probably never gained our independence or had a constitutional republic set up, that unique form of government that exists. You know, Washington's Christian character was evident throughout his life. As a young colonel in his early 20s, he commanded the frontier forces of Virginia during the French and Indian War. And at the end of the war, his officers wrote to him, praising him and giving him much tribute. And most of those officers, by the way, were older than Washington. He was just in his 20s. And they ended the letter, "In you we place the most implicit confidence. Your presence is all that is needed to cause a steady firmness and vigor to actuate in every breast, despising the greatest dangers and thinking light of toils and hardships, while led on by the man we know and love." So Christian strength and character were already manifested in his life, even as a young man in his early 20s. Now, Washington gives a good example of how God will prepare us so we may be able to accomplish his plan and purposes for us and fulfill the destiny he has for each one of us. From his youth, George's parents taught him Christian qualities and helped develop godly character within him. So this preparation principle is demonstrated in Washington's life, that God providentially prepared him to accomplish his mission for God's plan of spreading liberty throughout the world and giving birth to this unique nation of the United States of America. An excellent book I would encourage you to find and read. It's called The Making of George Washington, written by William Wilbur. And it's a unique book because most of it is looking at the youth and the training and the preparation of George Washington. What were the forces that shaped the character of George Washington from a boy, from a growing up as in his home all the way through his teen years? How was this character built within him that was so instrumental and necessary during the American Revolution, the constitutional period, and others, as we've given you a few examples of? And so, you know, I encourage you to go and find this book, but I want to just read a couple of excerpts from Wilbur's The Making of George Washington, where he presents some incidences in Washington's life that helped prepare him. These were educational and character-building incidences that shaped Washington that can be a great example for us today. One of the lessons that he learned from his parents was the idea of obeying cheerfully. You know, it's important for children to obey their parents, but it's not, and obey God, but it's not just obedience, it's cheerful obedience, because God wants us to obey from the heart. So William Wilbur writes in The Making of George Washington this story. Father August, now August was George Washington's father's name. Father August was just as interested in obedience as Mother Mary was. Mary was his mother. He implemented his instruction by introducing George at a very early age to a few of the rules of conduct which he had learned at Appleby Grammar School in England. August was careful to differentiate between the Ten Commandments and the Appleby rules. The Ten Commandments, he told the children, cover the major moral issues of life. There's nothing that equals them in definitiveness or general application to our greatest problems. However, there are many everyday matters of lesser importance which the Ten Commandments do not cover. At Appleby Grammar School in England, where I went to school as a very small boy, they had an excellent set of rules. These rules give us a very good guide to many minor aspects of our conduct. Take the basic idea of obedience, he continued. It is not sufficient just to obey. You must learn to obey cheerfully. That isn't always easy. For example, if your mother corrects you, or I do, or you are told to do something over again, you may not like it. Then simple obedience is not enough. The way in which you accept the correction becomes even more important than the obedience. One of the Appleby rules was designed to guide us in such a situation. It was, accept corrections thankfully. It is an excellent rule, but one that isn't always easy to carry out. Spend some time thinking about it. Then Augustine stated the rule again, accept corrections thankfully. So here we have just one incident of how George's father instructed him in important character qualities he carried with him for life. Here's another example presented by William Wilbur in The Making of George Washington regarding think before you speak. In teaching his children, August had a quiet way of employing a simple practical illustration to explain his meaning and to drive home the lesson. For example, one day George lost his temper and blurted out an unwarranted extreme remark because his sister Betty did not understand something he was trying to teach her. The quiet, kindly little girl was hurt and started to cry. By the time that Father August had grasped the situation, George was very sorry what he had done. With some deliberateness, August cut two branches from a bush, then said, "Here are two branches that I've cut from the bush. I want each of you to take a branch and break it into two separate sticks." In a moment, each child had two halves, each one frayed at the point where it had been broken. "George," August then said, "can you put your two pieces back together, just as they were before you broke them?" George put the frayed end of his sticks together, but realized at once the hopelessness of the task. "Betty, can you put your stick back together? Make it as good as new?" The little girl put the ends together and then ruefully shook her head. "No, Father," she said, "I can't." "You both agree," said August, "that you can't put them together." "I can't either." "No human being can. No matter how much we may wish to do so, we can never put the pieces back together. We cannot undo what we have done." Then he went on, "These sticks illustrate a very important lesson. Just before I asked you to break them, George lost his temper and said something for which he is now very sorry. He wishes oh so deeply that he could somehow bring back those words and unsay them. But no matter how sorry you may be, George, you cannot recall those harsh, unwarranted terms. The words are something like the stick. It is broken into two parts, and the two parts can never be put back together. One of the rules that I learned at Appleby Grammar School fits our problem very well. It was a simple one. Think before you speak. Another Appleby rule also applies. It was speak no injurious words, either in jest or in earnest. August didn't need to say more. And I want to just relate one more story from William Wilbur's The Making of George Washington. And by the way, he wrote that book not intending it necessarily to be a child-raising book, but it's an excellent book to read to help give you insight into how to raise your children. So when you read it, you're going to learn about Washington, this important figure in our history, the most important figure in our history. But it's also going to help you give you principles of how to train your children so that we can raise up many George Washingtons today. So here's one final story from William Wilbur. George's size and strength were often commented on by well-meaning friends and neighbors. When such a thing happened, Father August made comment like, "George, we're all very pleased that you are big and strong, But while you also can be pleased, you should realize that you have no reason to preen yourself about it. My father was a big man. He passed on to me an unusually fine, powerful body. The Lord has seen fit to pass it on to you. You have not achieved it by your own thinking or working. It is entirely a gift from others. The same would be true, Father went on, if someone should tell you or your sister Betty that you are handsome, have beautiful hair or fine eyes or a nice mouth. You have no cause to assume credit for any of these. They are all a gift from your parents and your grandparents. But if someone would say, George is a very well-behaved boy, how obedient and thoughtful George is, or how considerate Betty is, how helpful both Betty and George are. If someone made comments like these, then the situation would be very different. Then you could be proud and somewhat satisfied because you yourself had created a situation that brought deserved praise. As a result of this kind of early training, George acquired both modesty and humility, qualities which he displayed throughout his life. So these are just a few little stories that give some insight into the preparation of George Washington. But God not only prepared Washington through the training of his parents, but also used his experiences in life to assure that he was well-equipped to fulfill his destiny. You know, at the age of 16, George traveled to the western wilderness of Virginia to survey land for Lord Fairfax. And while here, he gained a personal knowledge of the country and a spirit of self-reliance, which would fit him for his later duties as commander of the army. At the age of 22, he delivered a message for the governor of Virginia to the French forces that occupied forts on the frontier of the colonies, and his experiences during this winter trek not only revealed the preparation of God, but also the protection of God, because he's almost killed by an Indian. He nearly drowned. He could have easily frozen to death, but he was miraculously preserved. Another incidence of God's providential care occurred during the French and Indian War, and I related this story in earlier podcast last year, but so good, let me remind you of it. You know, Washington was second in command to British General Braddock as the British and colonial troops marched out into the wilderness to drive the French off of British territory. Now, Washington tried to warn Braddock that European military tactics wouldn't work in the American frontier, but the general wouldn't listen, and so they were soundly defeated, marching right out in great targets with their red coats on, with the French and Indians hiding behind the rocks and trees. And it was only Washington's fearlessness and the Virginia militia that saved the day. During this battle, General Braddock was slain. Washington had 4 bullets pass through his coat, 1 bullet through his hat, and 2 horses shot from under him. Yet he escaped unhurt, as he later wrote, although death was leveling my companions on every side of me. Well, Washington was fired upon numerous times from near point-blank range and remained unharmed. An Indian who took part in the battle later stated, Washington was not born to be killed by a bullet, for I had 17 fair fires at him and after all could not bring him to the ground. The chief and several of the Indians had singled out Washington to kill him, and when they could not, they concluded that he was under the protection of the Great Spirit, had a charmed life, and could not be slain in battle. In a letter he wrote to his brother, not long after this incident, Washington said, but by the all-powerful dispensations of Providence, I've been protected beyond all human probability or expectation. 15 years later, Washington met an Indian chief who was at this Battle of the Monongahela and who had given orders to his men to try to kill Washington. And upon witnessing a power mightier far than we, he said. This Indian said to Washington, who shielded him from harm. The chief went on to say, the Great Spirit protects that man and guides his destinies. He will become the chief of nations, and a people yet unborn will hail him as the founder of a mighty empire. So even Indian chiefs were prophesying of God's intended purpose for George Washington. Reverend Samuel Davies, he was a leader in the First Great Awakening, preached a sermon on August 17, 1755, wherein he cites the preservation of young Washington. And he spoke in his sermon of that, quote, that heroic youth, Colonel Washington, whom I cannot but hope Providence has hitherto preserved in so signal a manner for some important service to his country. So as commander of the Virginia forces from age 23 to age 26, he learned struggles of securing men, money, and goods, which is exactly the same thing he faced during the Revolutionary War. Historian Washington Irving writes, in the hand of heaven he stood to be shaped and trained for its great purpose. And every trial and vicissitude of his early life but fitted him to cope with one or other of the varied and multifarious duties of his future destiny. So he recognized God and his providence, prepared him, gave him the things, watched over him, gave him the experiences and skills, insight, knowledge that he would need to accomplish his purpose. Before General Lee said that Washington, and at the death of George Washington, General Lee gave a speech to the Congress, and in that speech, the famous line that Washington was first in war, first in peace, and first in the hearts of his countrymen. Many individuals had heard that, but in his speech, just prior to that comment, that phrase, General Lee observed, quote, the finger of an overruling providence pointing at Washington as the man designed by heaven to lead us in war and peace was not mistaken. He laid the foundations of our policy and the unerring principles of morality based on religion. And so God's providential preparation of Washington was instrumental in bringing liberty to America and the world. And that's what this podcast, it's entitled America's Providential History. And we've taken a look over from last year and the months of this year at so many of the movings of God in our nation. We recognize and see that God in his providence has advanced his purposes in history. He's had a unique purpose for mankind, and America has a unique role that it's played in fulfilling those purposes. And George Washington is one of those men, and one that was instrumental in assuring that America became a nation and was set in on the proper foundation. And we've taken a look at just a few of the incidences of how God prepared him, how God watched over him, gave him the things he needed to play his part in the story of the advancing of God's purpose in history. And you can read a lot more in my book, Apostle of Liberty, The World-Changing Leadership of George Washington. You can get that at our website, providencefoundation.com. You can also read kind of this summary of these last two podcasts in my book, In God We Trust Tour Guide, on the chapter of Mount Vernon and Washington. And so I hope this encourages you, because God in his providence not only moved and prepared George Washington, but God has a purpose for all of his people. Now, that includes you and includes me. Now, few people are going to come to the status and the influence of George Washington, but every one of our parts and purposes in God's plan is just as important as anyone else's, because we who knows the influence that we're going to have directly or indirectly as God advances his plan for this nation and his plan for mankind. So all of us have a responsibility and a duty to seek the Lord, to find out what he might want us to do, to prepare ourselves so that we can be most effective in accomplishing our mission, whether great or small, because as we all do our part, where God in his providence is orchestrating all things to inch forth his plan and purpose for mankind. And he's not through with America. We've explored some of that in past podcasts, and we'll continue to look at that. And so here we are, just looking at a series on the faith of many of our presidents. And we began to look at George Washington and are looking at him in a little more detail because of his importance. And in the next couple of podcasts, I then want to explore specifically the Christian faith of George Washington. And we'll look at that and what he believed and what he said and what he did, and answer the question, was he a Christian? Some claim today that he was a deist at best, or a lukewarm Episcopalian, or nothing at all. And so what is true? And so we're going to explore that in upcoming podcast, after which we'll look at the faith of other of our presidents. So thanks for joining us in this podcast, and I hope to have you back next week. If you want some more information about the Providence Foundation, go to our website, providencefoundation.com, and you can pick up lots of books. And by the way, we have a number of free articles that you can read on there, one on the faith of George Washington, and other articles on Washington and others of our founding fathers. And so you can go and take a look at those. And I want to remind you too, that new film of ours that we've recently released, Educated for Liberty, can be viewed for free at educatedforliberty.com. Please take a look at it and share it with everybody you know, because it's the message in there is vital for the future of our nation. And so I would invite you to do that. Well, thanks for joining us, and hope to have you back next week. God bless you.